Once a month, our investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with stories of high strangeness and superb investigations, and she's done it again. Tonight, we will be talking about Rendlesham and Bentwaters' incredible UFO cases. Now, also get to coasttocoastam.com and look at the photographs that Linda has sent us. Earthfiles.com is her website, and up next is a remarkable story with Linda Moulton Howe. Do we need a drum roll? Of course not. We have Linda Moulton Howe with us. Linda, how are you?
I am good. And George, since a month ago only, so much has happened since I interviewed Colonel Charles Hault, who was that former deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters, England.
Yeah, absolutely. It just keeps rolling in, doesn't it?
It is. And since our last coast, in which we heard not only from Colonel Hault, going on the record for the first time in a press release in June and then doing the interview with me that you could hear on Coast, and which he said that the light phenomena in the Rendlesham Forest, December 26th to 28th, 1980, was, quote, extraterrestrial in origin, close quote. Mm. He is the first high-ranking officer who was there to go on the record and say that word, extraterrestrial. And since that particular series of interviews a month ago, I have received reports from others in security at that time, including one from a man who has never talked before. He is Richard Bertolino. He's now 48 years old, living in Spring Hill, Florida. And he left the Air Force in May 1981. Traveled and worked around the world, and now drives over-the-road trucks throughout the United States. Richard entered the American Air Force in 1979, immediately out of high school. He was given a choice about where he would like to be stationed, and he chose RAF Bentwaters because his dad had been stationed there during World War II. Richard Bertolino did basic and security training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, like all of these guys going into security. And he arrived at RAF Bentwaters in October 1979. And between that month and December 1980, which would have been about a year and a month or so later, nothing that was unusual. He didn't hear about anything except, now this is the first time I'd heard about this, Eastgate Charlie, a legendary ghost that supposedly haunts the East Gate of RAF Woodbridge.
How bizarre.
Yes, and this is a legend that goes back to World War II, and soldiers working security at the East Gate then had periodically seen dark humanoid shadows walking in the fog at night. And Richard said when he was there that there were guys who were kind of spooked being at the East Gate because of whatever the shadowy figure is. Does it have anything to do with why Rendlesham Forest is the focus of phenomena? Question mark. Well, the Christmas holiday in December 1980 had been really normal, uneventful. Airman First Class Richard Bertolino had a normal holiday, and then a little after midnight in the early morning of December 26th, he was on duty in what is called post security four at RAF Bentwaters. He was in an alert response team for the weapons storage area that everyone there working knew contained nuclear weapons, even though the United States had an agreement with Great Britain to not have nuclear weapons. What unfolded for Airman Bertolino and his security colleague, Sergeant Hall, would come to be known as the first night of the RAF Bentwaters and Rendlesham Forest UFO mystery. And today, 29 years later, former Airman Bertolino now provides eyewitness testimony that one of the men who went into the Rendlesham Forest to identify the mysterious, strange, fiery lights did in fact sketch a triangle-shaped craft encountered on the forest floor that first night. And that man was Staff Sergeant James W. Peniston, who sat next to Airman Bertolino on the bus later that morning when they went to drop off weapons at the end of their security shifts. Sergeant Peniston showed Airman Bertolino his drawing of the triangle-shaped craft of unknown origin. And here now is Richard Bertolino.
All of a sudden, on the radio, someone starts yelling, there's a UFO out here. Well, at that time, it registered to me and Sergeant Hall that there probably is a UFO out there. And Security 6 got the call to go out there. That was Sergeant Peniston.
Sergeant James Peniston.
Yes. He went out there, and we went to a place called Bunker Hill because we knew it was the highest point that we could get to on base. It's just basically a hill in a flight zone with a bunker on top of it for airbase ground defense.
Because you and Sergeant Hall wanted to look for the UFO.
Correct. When we got up there, we could not quite see a long distance over trees, but one thing I'll never forget was we saw a luminescent glow because he was saying, the woods are all lit up, the woods are all lit up. And in that glow, I don't know how to describe it. It's not like a light that continually traveled. You know, it didn't have that property of a flashlight or a light bulb that illuminated an area. It almost had a dome quality to it, like it lit a certain area and that was it. It was a strange light.
You were looking at what appeared to be half of a sphere of light out in the woods that you could see?
Correct. Probably about the size of a football field.
Wow. That big?
Yes, that big. It wasn't an object. It was just light. You know how a light will leave an area that's lit up around it and it fades out? This was an area that was lit up, but at a certain point, it looked like it cut off from fading. Does that make sense?
It does. And when you and Sergeant Hall saw this enormous sort of sphere of light covering a football field size, what did you say to each other?
I think probably some choice words, you know, holy was the lead into it.
Are you on radio so that you can hear what Sergeant Peniston is reporting?
Correct. He's not even out there yet. They were in the process of going out there when I remember Jim Peniston. He was saying that, yeah, the woods are all lit up. At about that time, he was saying he saw a blue and orange beacon-type light. Security control came back and said, well, be advised it could be a downed aircraft. And so they were told to go investigate. I'm pretty sure without the downed aircraft part, we probably couldn't have gone out there because it was off base. So they started going out there, and that was about the time probably I was going up the hill and we started seeing that. All of a sudden, Jim comes back because the light went out, the bright light. He goes, it's dark out here, and I will never forget him saying that the blue and orange beacon light are still there. The people that I know that were out there was Master Sergeant Chandler, who was at the edge of the woods because he gathered everyone's weapons. He didn't want them going out there with their weapons. He stayed at his Jeep. Airman First Class Cabanasac, Airman Longero, and Sergeant Peniston. I hear him. He is taking control, and he was doing all the transmissions to security control. As they were going into the woods, I'll never forget the one transmission that first made my hair stand up, and it still does to this day. You can hear, you know, a little bit of heavy breathing walking through the woods. He's breathing a little heavy, and he says, security control, the object is about 150 feet in front of us. And then, I mean, it was just a matter of a couple of seconds. He comes back, and his breathing is a little heavier, and he goes, security, do you copy that the object is behind us now? That's one I'll never forget. We relayed some of the transmissions from Bunker Hill until he left Cabanasac behind to do that. Because we had a great triangulation being on the hill to them in the woods, to the object, to security control.
How would you explain that radio transmission of Sergeant Peniston of the object being 150 feet in front and then behind, all within what appeared to be seconds on the radio transmission?
From what he told me, it just glided through the woods. No noise whatsoever. Pretty soon they came back and we had radio silence. I still don't know how that happened because from what I understand, they still had their same radios, but we could no longer pick up transmissions.
So you left Bunker Hill?
Correct.
Did you keep trying to listen on a radio to see if you could pick up Sergeant Peniston again?
Oh, yes. We had the radio in the truck, and each of us also had a side Motorola radio that we kept switching between them believe there was three channels on it, three or four channels, and never could hear anything else. And the next thing I know, we get picked up from our patrol duty by the relieving. We were C flight. Morning flight was A flight. They were coming on duty, and they'd drive around in a bus and drop off and pick up the different posts. I sat right next to Jim Pattison, and we were talking about it, and he seemed shook up. You could tell that something happened to him. And Jim says to me, it's a good thing that they couldn't take their weapons out there, because he was afraid that him or someone else might have shot at this thing when they first approached it, because it was so different that they didn't know how to react to it. And he said if one of them would have shot it, there would have probably been a pair of smoking boots sitting there. I think he meant that they were so far above us that it's not even funny. You know, their technology was so far advanced to ours that a bullet would be a joke.
Do you remember what else happened? What did he say? What was he doing?
He was describing some of the situation, and he pulled out this little notebook that he used to write incidents in, like if he was called to an incident. He always kept notes. Well, he pulls out the notebook, and he diagrams what he saw out there. It was kind of diamond-shaped with tripod legs. And he explained that it wasn't like any metal he had ever seen. I'm really getting into this, and we get in to turn in our weapons. And I think one thing that drove me nuts from that day forward was, here's guys that we would fight side by side and die with each other if we had to. These guys wouldn't talk about it anymore. I almost felt like, I don't know, I felt kind of betrayed, you know, because they shut in. I mean, we all still got along. But anytime it would be brought up, they just could not talk about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What was said to them to clam them up so tight, I have no idea. But I would like to talk to Jim about that one of these years.
When you heard Colonel Charles Hault in my interview with him broadcast on Coast the night of August 27th.
Correct.
What was your reaction to hearing your former deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters saying the lights that he encountered in the forest on the 28th of December were, quote, extraterrestrial in origin, close quote?
I thought it was great that he had the gumption to come forward. I mean, I saw three people that I was friends with that wouldn't even talk about it anymore. So their power to shut people up is pretty strong.
And I wonder who the they are.
At the time of the situation, I guess they were OSI. That's what I thought.
Well, you do know that there are a lot of people working for the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency who wear uniforms in various military positions, but they actually report to and get their checks from DIA or NSA.
And at that time, if you would have said NSA, I would say, what is that, the division of NASA?
You did not know about the National Security Agency in 1980.
No, I did not.
Richard, what was your thought when you realized that it had taken Colonel Hault 30 years to say what you all thought back then was the truth, that this was extraterrestrial in origin?
It still took a hell of a lot of nerve for him to do that, even after all these years. I mean, I applaud the man. I'm sure that he has a military pension that he has to worry about, and that would have been a big concern for him, I'm sure. They can make things miserable for him. I mean, his pension could suddenly stop coming, and though it's a paper error, you know, they, whoever they are, have the power. And I hate to say it that way like a conspiratorialist, but, you know, it's true.
Did you know when you were at RAF Bentwaters that there were nuclear weapons in the weapons storage area?
Yes.
I think everybody did.
I know. And it was so funny because they even had public maps of the two bases. And on the Woodbridge base, it actually said it, non-nuclear weapons storage area. And on Bentwaters, it had weapons storage area with the double fence, the concertina wire, the bright lights, you know. I mean, I found out later that there was actually a couple of other spots where it supposedly, quote, landed. But I never did see those.
So maybe three sites in all where there were the same kind of triangular pattern of circles?
That's what I understand, yes. I think the craziest part of the whole thing was that morning, the void of animals. And to see those cows huddled in the corner, and I had never known about the fire lights that Colonel Holt was talking about,
right,
where they thought the farm was on fire. To see those cows in that corner like that, I wish I would have had a camera then, because it was one of the most bizarre things I'd ever seen.
And George, this is when Richard Bertolino went out into the forest where they were looking at a physical site that had holes into the ground anywhere between 1 to 3 inches going right through the pine needles and the debris. And there were these, they weren't bowls. He said, if you took a coffee can and you just, and it was sharp, and you went right down through the thick pine needles on the floor at Rendlesham Forest, mm-hmm, where this thing landed, and you took every pine needle, bug, and piece of residue, and that the soil was as clean as if it had been vacuumed in perfect circles, 4.5 feet apart in a triangular pattern. That's where he was. Captain Verano was out there, and Colonel Holt emailed me and said that after looking at Richard Bertolino's interview at earthfiles.com, that where Richard remembered seeing Captain Verano out there photographing, Colonel Holt said that there was a Sergeant Ray Gullius who was taking photographs, and Colonel Holt emailed me and said, quote, somewhere I have seen photographs that Ray Gullius took of the landing site the morning of the first event, which would have been December 26th. Another confirmation that they were out there doing physical evidence examination and taking photographs of a landing site. And Richard Bertolino was there and saw it with his own eyes. And it is there, which was not far from that farm, that they couldn't get over how the cows were cowering. He went into much more detail about how they were actually huddled with their heads down far away. He'd never seen cows do that before. So whatever happened scared those cattle. And another thing about the photographs, in the 1997 book Left at Eastgate by Larry Warren and Peter Robbins, they have a quote from the captain and day shift commander, Mike Verano, saying this, quote, I did drive General Gordon Williams, and he was the overall commander at the 81st Division. I did drive General Gordon Williams to an F-16 on the Bentwaters tarmac the morning of December 30th. He had two canisters of 35-millimeter footage with him, and he told me directly that it was actual footage of the UFOs, plural, on the ground, close quote.
Isn't that dramatic?
It is.
Riveting.
It really is. And wait until you hear what is coming in this next half hour of an interview that I have done recently with Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston, who was out there in the forest with Airman John Burroughs, Airman Ed Kvansak. And now you have heard for the first time another airman who was with Wendell Palmer on Bunker Hill on the radio. They were listening to the radio as they were getting into the forest for the first hour, and then security control called for radio silence. This has puzzled Richard Bertolino all of these years, for three decades. Why did they cut them off? Why did they call for radio silence? Well, recently, in this past few months, John Burroughs, the airman with Jim Peniston, talked with the shift commander that night, Lieutenant Fred Skip Baran, and he was the highest authority working on that night of the 26th. Jim Peniston needed his permission to go out into the forest, and Lieutenant Baran told John Burroughs recently that the reason they called for radio silence is that for 45 minutes, they could not make radio contact with Jim Peniston.
What a remarkable case. More with Linda Moulton Howe in the Bentwaters case on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got Linda Moulton Howe, our investigative reporter, tracking down the Bentwaters in the Rendlesham case, an incredible UFO story. Last hour of the night tonight, it'll be Conversations with Linda, where we take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, and we've got Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, I'll let you get right into the second part.
Thanks, George. storage, and you and our Coast listeners can see a lot of really good photographs, sketches, and documents from the RAF Bentwaters mystery, including the weapons storage area and a section of it that was known by the guys who worked there as Hot Row. And you can guess what was in Hot Row underground. All of this is at my news website, earthfiles.com, and at the top of the headlines are hot links to all of my reports tonight. And so many new details are emerging that it is hard to realize that this happened almost 30 years ago. December 26, 1980, was when former RAF Bentwaters Staff Sergeant James W. Peniston was RAF Woodbridge Security Supervisor that night of December 26. Jim was 26 years old then, and he had been in the U.S. Air Force since 1973. He had graduated from Freeport High School in Freeport, Illinois, and gone right into the U.S. Air Force. And on that fateful night of December 26, after midnight, Sergeant Peniston received a radio call from Central Security Control asking him to go to the RAF Woodbridge East Gate. When Sergeant Peniston arrived, he could see fiery reddish-orange light in the trees, and he assumed it was a crashed airplane on fire. He asked Law Enforcement Supervisor Staff Sergeant Bud Steffens, when did it crash? But Steffens answered sort of enigmatically that it did not crash, it landed. Puzzled, Sergeant Peniston called the 81st Police Squadron Shift Commander, Lieutenant Fred Skip Buran, and asked for an Eastern radar check. Lieutenant Buran told Sergeant Peniston there was an object over the base and that, quote, something had disappeared off radar, close quote. That convinced Lieutenant Buran to give Sergeant Peniston permission to go off base to investigate. Peniston wanted Steffens to go with him into the woods, but Steffens did not want to leave the base property. This was off the base, out in the woods. So Airman John Burroughs volunteered to join Sergeant Jim Peniston and Airman Ed Kavansak. The three men drove together in a pickup as far as they could to the trees. They parked, and they walked closer to the mysterious, colorful lights. Their radios were interrupted by very unusual static, and Sergeant Peniston asked Kavansak to go back toward the truck and act as a radio relay with Central Security Control. Retired Staff Sergeant Jim Peniston begins now with his and John Burroughs' approach to the bright lights in Rendlesham Forest on December 26, 1980.
It was apparent that it wasn't an aircraft crash. There was no fire. There was no fumes or anything like that from anything burning. What it was a very bright light illuminating from the forest floor.
Color?
Bright white.
So it's no longer the red, the orange, and the blues. It is now only white.
Correct. Very hard to see at that point in time.
It was so bright.
Yeah, it was very luminous, yes.
Do you remember Airman First Class John Burroughs is the only person with you at that point?
That's correct. It was John and I, and when we approached the craft, what I wanted to do is to establish what I had is a craft of unknown origin sitting in front of me, and I was going to ascertain whether or not that this was hostile or a threat to the resources on the base.
What are you seeing in the light with your own eyes and mind?
It was a triangular craft. The fabric of the craft was black like glass. And then throughout the fabric of the craft, there was some coloring, lighting, varying from saucer shape to pie-shaped circles that moved around the craft. They were colored, some were red, blue, some yellow, or orange, I guess more orange. John is still with me, and I start taking observations in the notebook to coordinate the time that I was there and what my actions were.
If you could give us a few more details about this black, glassy triangle that you are seeing, what look like changing geometric patterns of different colors below the glass or above the glass?
Predominantly below the glass on the underside of the craft, and then occasionally moving around the upper side of the craft itself. It appeared that the coloring was part of the actual craft fabric. It made no sense. I've never seen anything that had that type of effect before.
Can you see through the black glass into the interior?
No, it was fully opaque. As we approached it, though, that's when I stepped off measurements of the craft. They measured approximately 9 feet long. That's three long steps with my stride. And approximately 6.5 feet tall. The fabric of the craft was completely opaque. It was glass-like. Occasionally, you would get some movement of color throughout the fabric of the craft itself. Sometimes a small blob that was probably 6 inches across the color, sometimes 12 inches across, but they were very sporadic color.
These were circles that would change their size from something like 6 inches to maybe 12 inches when they moved over the surface of this dark black glass?
That is correct. It's hard to describe, but I think what stands out in my memory is the blackness of the craft. The best way to describe it, if you took a onyx stone and you had an onyx stone that measured 9 feet long and 6 feet high, that's what you would see.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah, to say the least. It was very unusual.
Were you thinking at that moment, this is not from Earth?
I knew that it was not from any form of government. I mean, no Air Force on Earth. No, it was beyond our capability.
Did you say to John Burroughs then, this looks like something from outer space?
I looked at John and I said, I don't know how in the hell we're going to explain this.
And do you remember what he said?
John says, we have a UFO here. I says, we have something here. I said, I don't know. But I said, I got to have quiet here. I got to have some quiet. And I did do the walk around the craft at that point in time. And as I walked around that craft, I already paced it off. This is my second or third time I was walking around it, mainly in awe. Toward the one side of the craft, there was markings on the craft, which were very unusual. They measured probably 2.5, 3 feet wide. There were a series of etchings. That's what it seemed like to me, like they're etched in the fabric of the craft. They felt that way to the touch anyway.
And when did you touch it?
Second or third go-around, I was walking around the craft. The first time around, I did measurements of the size. Second time, I was looking for compartments or crew compartment or a window or something. And it was completely void of all that. It was a completely smooth surface. Since there was no indication that there was going to be anything hostile from it, it was doing absolutely nothing. It was benign at that point. I consider it was not a threat to the base itself. As I walked around examining it, I was looking underneath. I touched it, and the feeling actually for that, the air temperature out there at the time was probably, 34 degrees, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very warm to the touch. I would say if I had to guesstimate the temperature, I would say it was probably like 60 degrees.
And you were feeling heat and what else?
Smoothness of the craft, trying to figure it out to feel like glass. But it can't be glass. It's got to be metal, at least with my experience. The craft would be metal, but it felt like glass. I was confused at that point because nothing in my training or in my past experience prepared me for what was going on. As I felt my way around the craft, I came upon the symbols that were on the craft, and I gave them a lot more attention, feeling each one, and then recording them in my notebook.
You've dragged your hand across the surface of this dark, glassy, triangular craft, and you put your fingers inside each of these symbols that you've drawn in your notebook.
Put my fingers on top of them. There was no indention. They just seem like an etching on the craft. If you had a sheet of smooth glass and you took a piece of sandpaper and you laid it on that glass, and running from the glass surface to the sandpaper, that's how it felt.
Oh, so it is not engraved in and it's not raised as much as it is a different surface texture.
Correct.
And when your fingers touch the symbol, did you have anything come into your mind in terms of thought or image?
Well, that's the part I just don't really know when it happened, but yeah, there was, did I feel intelligence? Yes.
Did anything go into your mind in terms of picture or thought?
None that I recall, but here's something that is odd. I lost track of John for like 45 minutes or so. I don't know where he was at, but I don't know if it was because I was mesmerized by what was going on in front of me or what. There was like a 45-minute gap of time there, which seemed like, I don't know, a couple of minutes. I don't know what caused the distortion.
John Burroughs cannot remember seeing you drawing in a notebook. He cannot remember seeing you touch the craft. He cannot remember seeing you photographing. And you did have a camera and take photos, correct?
Correct.
What do you remember about that period when you were photographing?
You know, I took as many photographs as I had in the camera and as fast as I could walking around the outside of the craft. They were before the first walk around.
So the first thing you did was take the photographs?
Yeah.
And did you walk around the craft when you took the photos?
A partial walk around. I did probably 90 to 160 degrees.
How many images were there?
I believe there was 36 on the roll.
This was 35 millimeter color negative in December 1980, correct?
It was black and white. I was going to use that if there was a crash scene.
You'd taken it out of the truck where you left Kabansack?
Yeah, I left the truck with it, yeah.
And if the very first action that you took was to use the camera with the black and white negative film in it to photograph this very unusual object in Rendlesham Forest, and John Burroughs does not remember you photographing, it means that John Burroughs was apparently not aware of what you were doing right from the beginning of your time close to the craft.
We were together. I don't have an explanation. What we were seeing was out of the ordinary. You know, and John was agitated, but it's understandable. I mean, he was excited, agitated from the time at East Gate all the way out there. I had more experience, been to a lot of crash sites.
When is your very next memory of John Burroughs?
When the light on the craft started to generate to a more white, brilliant light is when I backed away from the craft. John was maybe 15 feet away, 20 feet away, standing there.
Because you were afraid of what was happening with this increasing light?
I wasn't sure what it was going to do. I don't know, explode, or I was concerned.
So both you and John are on the ground flat?
Right, on the prone position, yes.
And then what happens?
The craft lifted off the forest floor, went to treetop level, and took off at an extreme rate of speed, and John and I stood up at that point in time. Nothing that I know of could be gone in a blink of an eye.
You remember recalling some mental impression or word thought that you relate to touching the symbols on the triangular craft?
Well, it was very hard to sleep at night after that, especially in the following 2 weeks. And I had this feeling, and the feeling was that there would be a return sometime of that craft. I don't know, it was just a very odd thought.
These people are incredible, Linda.
Well, these are the people who were there. All of these silly nonsense internet things that are now emerging from people that are saying that what was one of the most recent ones, that a farmer or a guy working on a farm took some kind of a trailer and had set it on fire and went through the forest as a joke. You've seen some of
that. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's preposterous. And recently, I think there was an email exchange with somebody who had emailed you and me, and I had replied that if this is the best misinformation that NSA, CIA, DIA, and NRO can come up with now in 2009, it relates to the recession. I don't know. But these are all really preposterous and silly stories. When we're listening tonight to the real people who were really there encountering phenomena that they did not know what to do with, they didn't understand. And not only was Jim Peniston troubled with nightmares and a problem with sleeping, but so was John Burroughs. Not only then, but today, as we're speaking in September of 2009, John Burroughs still has trouble sleeping, still has dreams/nightmares. And over the past year, I have been trying to help him work with a hypnotherapist in trying to break through a very strong mental block that he has. We have made some progress. We are continuing to do the work. And there is no one on this planet who wants to remember all of the details more than former Airman John Burroughs, who will be coming up in this next half hour. And when you hear the power of Jim Peniston, and then followed by John Burroughs, who was not only there in the forest with Jim Peniston and Ed Kubansak on the 26th, John Burroughs was back in the forest when Colonel Halt was there with the tape recorder and other men two nights later on the 28th. And the amazing thing about this is that for 30 years, I remember back in the early 80s, I was hearing rumors from people who were saying that in the December 26th to 28th, no one was able to say which date, that John Burroughs jumped up on a craft or was seen by several eyewitnesses rising in light into a craft in the air. That has been a three-decades-long rumor. Well, John talked with Adrian Bastinza, who was with him on that third night of December 28th, by phone in the last year or two. And Adrian Bastinza back then told John that he saw light come over him, and recently confirmed again that Bastinza felt like he was pushed to the ground by something that forced him to the ground, but he could see John with light coming over John and disappearing. This is what we are trying to penetrate. John wants to know what happened and why is it that some of the men who were up in the radar towers or the towers, the watchtowers over the WSA, some of them said that they also saw or heard that John was taken up in a light that at that moment, from John's memory, was not white, but was red-orange on that third night in the forest, and Colonel Halt was behind him. These are the real people, George, and this is why this may be one of the most major events on record.
More to come. And by the way, Linda, on the first week of November, that weekend, we'll be at Ryan Wood's UFO Crash Retrieval Conference in the Las Vegas area. More information on that by going to her website at earthfiles.com.